Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program online at carthage.edu/Aspire. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be deviating from the published schedule of programs for today and tomorrow. Today we're going to be hearing the interview originally scheduled to air tomorrow with Dr. Ron Kronovich, professor of economics at Carthage College. We'll get to that interview in just a moment. Tomorrow we will air the interview originally scheduled for today with E. Dolores Johnson, the author of a powerful and poignant memoir called Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. E. Dolores Johnson, in her book, talks about the experience of growing up with a father who was black and a mother who was white. And this was at a time when racially mixed marriages were illegal in many states across the country and frowned upon by a large swath of the American population. I wanted to air that interview tomorrow rather than today, since tomorrow is known as Juneteenth or Freedom Day or Jubilee Day, a holiday celebrating the ending of slavery. So again, tomorrow on the Morning Show is when you can hear that conversation with E. Dolores Johnson talking about her book, Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. In the meantime, I'm excited now to share with you my conversation with Professor Kronovich. Enjoy. And we welcome you to the Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really happy to be speaking today with a faculty colleague from Carthage, namely Dr. Ron Kronovich, who is professor of economics at Carthage. He's been there since 2008. He teaches an array of courses related to the field of economics, and one of the areas of special interest for him for quite some time has been that of poverty and what causes poverty, where poverty is most prevalent, and various strategies in terms of combating poverty. And we're going to be talking with Professor Kronovich today about, first of all, the current state of the American economy and how different indications sort of help us gauge just what's going on with this current economy, which of course has been racked with all kinds of difficulty, and we'll kind of look ahead to what might be the next step for our economy, and then focus on some issues that will actually take us into the realm of communities of color and how poverty is a very real factor in their lives, and what is going on, and also the way in which the COVID-19 crisis has impacted communities of color in very, very negative ways, in ways that are probably tied to some of these other issues that speak to poverty and injustice and so on. So we have a lot to cover, and Professor Ron Kronovich, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me on the morning show, Greg.
Glad to have you. Before we get into these weighty matters, I have to mention that right at the top of your own biography on our website is the fact that you actually spent years in very serious music study related especially to jazz. Just tell us a little bit about this background of music and how music at some point, at least in terms of your professional life, seems to have been shunted to the side.
So I started playing piano around age 3, and I studied it more formally, probably starting around age 7 or 8. For the next probably 10 years, my plan was to become a professional musician. I just loved playing piano, composing, arranging for big band. I was really into jazz. I was in some high school rock bands. We played at high school dances and things like that. Then I joined a band professionally, played in a funk band in the Detroit area for a year. That was a whole lot of fun. But then I found my true love, economics. Sort of a strange journey.
Is there any relationship between the two? I mean, are they parts of two separate aspects of your soul? Or are there ways in which what made you and probably still makes you a joyous musician also feeds the interest you have in economics?
Well, they are connected. Both have math in them. Learning music kind of helped me learn economics better. You know, you have to be disciplined, you have to approach it sort of analytically, break it down into the different components, and all of that applied to learning economics too. I feel like studying music really improved my ability to learn. It made me be a better learner in college for sure, and especially with economics. Mm-hmm. And they both fields also have room for creativity and joy. So I'm pretty excited with the way things turned out.
Great. I also wanted to ask you a real basic question, although it's not a very basic question for me, and probably for a lot of our listeners. When I looked over your list of courses that you have taught or are currently teaching at Carthage, some of them mention macroeconomics and some of them mention microeconomics. Can you explain the distinction between the two?
Sure. Macroeconomics is the study of sort of large parts of the economy. Like we talk about the labor market, even though in the real world, there really isn't one labor market. There's the market for healthcare workers, and that can be broken down into many subfields, and auto workers and so forth, manufacturing jobs, service jobs. And macro, we focus on sort of big things, like the total amount of economic output in the country, and not so much which companies are doing better than other companies and things like that. So macroeconomics, gross domestic product, the economic output of the country, the overall unemployment rate, and the overall inflation rate, things like that. Microeconomics, on the other hand, focuses on smaller units, like the behavior of households, the behavior of businesses in different industries, and things like that. So they're both actually interrelated. We teach them separately to undergraduates, but the more you learn about economics, the more you see that micro and macro are sort of linked together in important ways.
Yeah, I suppose the behavior of people or the behavior of companies depends to some extent, I suppose to a large extent, on what's going on in terms of the big picture. And the big picture probably springs out of the collective living and operation of people and companies and so on. I can see how that's a very much a two-way street.
Yes, that is absolutely right. You're well on your way to becoming an economics professor, if you like. Although you're good at a lot of other things, too.
I'm excited to be able to talk with you about the current state of our economy and the fact that when one wants to assess something like that, there are all kinds of different things that one can look at. And it's probably fair to say that most of us tend not to do that enough. I mean, we tend to pretty much limit ourselves to the unemployment numbers or the Dow Jones Industrial Average or whatever it might be, or whatever the headlines happen to be in the paper, versus a more comprehensive understanding of all the different aspects or components of the economy and how certain components can be in very positive territories and others can be a real cause for concern. How would you assess how things are right now?
Well, things really are kind of bad right now. Over 20 million people are out of work. The official unemployment rate is 13.3%, although due to an error in collecting the data, it's actually more like 16.3%. So normally in recessions, the unemployment rate goes up maybe from a normal value of 5% up to maybe 8% or so, and we're at probably 16 or 17% unemployment. So this is really a much worse recession than we've had any time in my lifetime, and probably that of most of your listeners. I think you have to go back to the Great Depression in the 1930s to see unemployment rates this high. So yeah, it's pretty bad.
What are other economic indicators, as we sometimes hear that term, that are worth paying attention to? And are there other indicators that paint a less dire picture of the current state of things?
Right. So that's a good question. There are a variety of indicators. And to get a good sense of what's happening in the economy, to the extent that that's even possible, it's harder when things are changing so rapidly, of course. But it's good to look at a variety of different indicators. The unemployment rate data comes out once a month. And when it comes out with a 1 month lag, right? So just last Friday, we got the unemployment numbers for May. And those were collected in probably the first half of May, right? So we don't really see what's been happening in real time by looking at the monthly unemployment rate. Now, there's another indicator that never really got a lot of attention before, at least not to me, which is how many people are applying for unemployment insurance. So this comes out every week with a 1 week lag. So normally around 200,000 people or so apply for unemployment insurance for the first time. That's sort of a measure of how many people have lost their jobs over the last week. And on March 21st, that number jumped up to 3.3 million.
Wow.
So the week prior to March 21st, 3.3 million people applied for unemployment insurance for the first time. The week after that was also over 6 million. The week after that was 5 million. So now we're over 20 million people applying for unemployment insurance. So this data is coming out not quite in real time, but with a 1 week lag as opposed to a 1 month lag. So we were able to learn from this data that we were in big trouble well before the Bureau of Labor Statistics released the monthly unemployment data.
So is it fair to say that we are in a recession? And if so, how serious a recession compared to other recessions we've experienced before?
So it is fair to say that we're in a recession. The National Bureau of Economic Research is the organization that officially dates recessions. So they determine when each recession started, when it ended, and they announced recently that the latest recession has started as of February. So we're in a recession. It looks like a bad one, but there's some indications that it might not be quite as long lasting. So recessions typically vary in duration and severity. Typically a recession will last from maybe 6 months to 18 months, and maybe 1 or 2 million people will lose their jobs during that time. We're looking at over 20 million people having lost their jobs in the last couple of months. And this is going to be a much deeper recession, but there are some indications that we will sort of bounce back from it more quickly than the last depression, which was the Great Depression of the 1930s. So for example, when the unemployment rate data is collected, people responding to the survey are asked to indicate some information about the type of unemployment. And one of the categories is people on temporary layoff, people who've been let go, but they expect to come back to their job. And normally, about 20% of unemployed people indicate that they're on temporary layoff. So if things start winding down and the economy starts going back to sort of to normal or some new normal, most people expect that they'll be getting their jobs back. So that is an indication that as horrible as this recession is, we might be kind of bouncing partway back from it sort of sooner than we would for a typical recession.
And of course, in some ways too, this is it. I mean, I suppose to the typical economist, when other serious recessions occur, you probably understand much better than the rest of us do, why are we suddenly in a recession? I mean, there are demonstrable reasons why our economy is suddenly suffering in a way that it wasn't before. I mean, I think to the average person, I count myself among them, we don't really understand why these things happen or when they, we don't see them necessarily coming. This recession, of course, feels very different in that, I mean, it's no mystery. Nobody should be surprised by these terrible unemployment numbers, because we all know what's closed right now or the things that are not happening right now. So in That's a sense, right. It makes sense. And none of this is inscrutable, which doesn't allay its severity, but at least it's not a mystery of why we are in the situation that
right.
we're in.
That's exactly right. So this is sort of a recession by design. The government shut down most of the economy for 2 months, all but the essential services. And that caused economic activity to drop. It caused employment to drop. And that was by design to limit the spread of this virus. So this is a recession by design. And this is the first such recession in my lifetime or that I've ever heard of where the government caused a recession to fight a public health crisis. Prior to this recession, I'd been teaching my students typical reasons for recessions would be a stock market crash that makes people feel poorer, so they stop spending money, or a housing market crash, which also makes people feel poorer and causes the value of people's houses to drop, often below the amount of mortgage debt that they have. So that's another reason for a recession. And finally, oil price shocks in the 1970s. Some of your older listeners or more mature listeners might recall that in the 1970s, the price of oil increased by more than a factor of 10 in 1973 and again in 1979, largely because of events happening in the Middle East. And as a result of these oil price shocks, inflation went up and unemployment went up, and the U.S. went through some very severe recessions in the 1970s. So these are examples of recessions that are caused by external shocks. And the current recession, as you say, is very different. It's caused by design. The government shut down most of the economy for a couple of months to address this public health crisis and try to slow down the spread of the virus.
It's probably good for us to remember, although you've already said that we're seeing numbers that have not been this bad since the Great Depression. One vast difference, of course, is that when the typical person found themselves suddenly unemployed in 1929 or 1930 or 1931, they had very little reason to hope that their situation was going to improve anytime soon. It felt like all kinds of things were just evaporated into thin air, perhaps never to return. And we're just not talking about the same kind of unemployment in this recession, at least not across the board. that this is, in a sense, a more temporary kind of unemployment, at least for many of these people who at the moment find themselves without a job.
Right. So it is almost certainly going to be shorter lasting than the Great Depression, which was essentially most of the 1930s. Where we go from here, though, is really shaky and depends on a lot of factors that are not known. The sort of good forecast would be if the number of new cases of COVID-19 infections continues to drop and we don't really see a second wave of infections, the economy is already starting to open back up and people are coming back to their jobs, and that'll continue to improve over the course of the rest of 2020 and into 2021. That's sort of the best case scenario, but we don't really know what the course of the coronavirus will be, right? So that's more a question for public health experts, some of whom are predicting kind of a second wave of infections in the late summer or fall. So if we have to go back into lockdown for a couple of more months, that's gonna, you know, send us right back into the worst place in terms of labor market and economic output, and it'll prolong this recession. So it really remains to be seen, and it's really going to be a function mainly of the trajectory of the coronavirus.
Right. And I suppose tied into that is, depending on what those numbers look like, it also depends on our level of risk acceptance, or to whatever extent we are collectively and personally able to absorb a certain amount of risk into our lives that, you know, we probably have not had to confront before.
That's absolutely right. The problem is we can't really quantify that risk. We can't know exactly how likely it is if we go to a concert or to see the movies in a room packed with a couple of hundred other people for 2 hours. We just don't know what is the likelihood of getting the virus. And if we get it, we don't know if we'll be one of the people who have to be hospitalized because it's severe, or we'll just get a light case, or maybe we won't even experience symptoms. There's just so much that's unknown.
Right. And of course, that fact that we don't have good, hard answers to those questions, that affects whether or not somebody would even go to the movies, even if a movie theater is open in your city. I mean, just because it's open doesn't mean that people will go and buy tickets and subject themselves to that situation. Certainly some
Absolutely.
Would. And others would find themselves fearful. Boy, it's interesting how much fear has to do with the economy, doesn't it?
Well, yes, that's exactly right. Uncertainty tends to be a big variable in people's decisions. Uncertainty depresses economic activity. People are more cautious. Businesses are less likely to engage in investment projects like expanding their factory or building another factory, or for individuals opening a business for the first time in the face of uncertainty. And people are ordinary consumers are less likely to buy a car or do things like that, right? Buying a car involves taking on a monthly car payment for most people of $400, $500 for maybe 5-6 years. And if you don't know if you're going to be employed next year, then it's probably not a great time to buy a new car and take on that debt, that new monthly financial obligation. So uncertainty really does depress economic activity.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Ron Kronovich, who is a professor of economics at Carthage College. Professor Kronovich, one of the areas of your own professional focus is that of poverty. And I wish we had more time to talk about this really important topic. We'll explore it in a little more detail on another day. But could you just speak for a moment about where we tend to see poverty and where the impact of poverty is most acute in the United States right now? And I am especially curious about sort of the divide between urban and rural poverty, because I think for a lot of people, when they hear the word poverty, they think of inner cities and do not necessarily think about rural America.
Right. So that's a good question. Rural and urban poverty are different things. I'm especially focused in my teaching and research on poverty and the effects of income and wealth inequality, and less focused on the differences and similarities between urban and rural poverty. But poverty is a huge problem, and poverty is increasing. Poverty is a problem even if you're not one of the poor, because the more poor people there are, the less economic activity and the more strain on the social safety net systems. So this really is something that affects everybody in different ways.
So when we're talking about things like income inequality, how do we see this in terms of communities of color? Just how serious are the disparities, and to what should we be attributing those disparities?
Well, the median household income of a white family is $71,000. And for a Black family, it's $41,000. So that's a pretty huge gap. The gap in wealth between the median white and median Black family is much bigger. And the wealth gap is really the thing that I'm worried about, because wealth sort of determines the family's wealth determines the family's ability to provide a good education and other kinds of resources for its children. So children who are lucky enough to be born to parents that are sort of middle income or upper middle income or higher are likely to have the resources needed to get a good college education and a good start in life. Black families have much less wealth, about one-tenth the wealth of white families on average. And that means if you're unlucky enough to be born to a family with little wealth, little financial resources, then your odds of being able to afford to go to college are much, much lower. And if you get into college, you'll probably be less prepared because you didn't have the same kinds of resources during the time prior to going to college. So then there's a greater chance of not making it to the end, not graduating, and ending up with a lot of college debt, but no college degree. So the wealth gap is really kind of important. And in the United States, there's very little social mobility and intergenerational mobility. Social mobility refers to the ability of somebody to sort of climb the economic ladder in their lifetime. And intergenerational mobility refers to the prospect that if you are born to poor parents, what are the chances that you are doomed to a life of poverty or can climb out of it? And both those kinds of economic mobility are much lower in the United States than in other high-income countries. So this means that children who are born to parents that have low wealth are likely to be poor, or much more likely to be poor when they're adults. And that's true whether you're Black or white. The difference is that African Americans are disproportionately represented among the poor, and people of color in general are disproportionately represented among the poor. So these gaps between Black and white persist over time because of the lack of economic mobility. And those gaps manifest in other ways, some of which are relevant to this health crisis that we're dealing with right now. Right, so you've probably heard in the news, probably many of your listeners have heard that the disease is affecting people of color more than whites. So that is partly a function of these wealth gaps. Families that don't have a lot of wealth are going to be less likely to have good health insurance. Another factor is that the way public schools are funded in this country kind of reinforces and perpetuates inequality. Public schools are largely financed by local property tax dollars. So if you happen to be born to a low-income community where property values are low, there's not going to be a lot of property tax dollars to provide resources for your school. If you're lucky enough to be born to a family that lives in a higher-income community where property values are higher, there are going to be more property tax dollars available to local authorities to provide good schools with excellent teachers and the best and most current textbooks and lab equipment and musical instruments and so forth. So that's another factor that leads to these differences over time. And getting back to the health crisis that we're facing now, so one of the reasons, there are a number of different reasons for the higher rates of infection and death among people of color, and especially African American. That's partly because they have less health insurance on average. They're more likely to be in high-risk categories because of differences in health outcomes. And also people of color are sort of disproportionately represented in the group of so-called essential workers, like healthcare workers, right? So healthcare workers, they're really at risk, right? Because they're coming into contact with the people who are infected. And unfortunately, we're like at least five months into this health crisis, and we still don't have enough protective equipment for all of our healthcare workers. Some of them are sort of reusing masks that should only be used one time and so forth. So healthcare workers are really at much greater risk of coming down with this illness. And people of color are disproportionately represented among healthcare workers on the front lines.
Interesting. And of course, I've read that they're also disproportionately represented when it comes to people who are stocking shelves or doing grocery shopping for others, and those kind of positions that we don't immediately think of as essential workers, but in fact, under the current circumstances, are exactly that.
One of the great lessons of this public health tragedy is that a lot of workers that we don't normally give a second thought about and who are not making a lot of money, really considered essential. I mean, think about it. During the lockdown for a couple of months, when most of us were not leaving our houses, except maybe these people who deliver packages, or who, you know, the Instacart workers, right, who bring us our groceries, like we really needed those people. And they're not making a lot of money, but it turns out that they're kind of what's helping the economy going in this crazy period, right? So maybe going forward, we want to give some thought as a society to sort of aligning the compensation of different groups more proportionately to their, you know, to their importance in helping us function, you know, in times of crisis as well as good times.
I want to circle back to the question of economic mobility, which you were just saying is not very strong in the United States and is a real issue when it comes to, for instance, certain communities of color where the possibility of climbing from one economic class to the one above it is very, very limited. I wonder if you have any historical perspective to share on that. I mean, if we were to look at that question of mobility 50 years ago or even 20 years ago, would we have seen mobility that was even less than it is now? Or has, in at least in some sectors, has it been better in the past and is it worse now? I mean, or has this been a kind of a perpetual reality that has been with us for a long time, but which we're just now really starting to seriously talk about?
Well, there are sort of two answers to that question. The first answer is that social mobility and intergenerational mobility have been declining in the United States, meaning it's harder for people to climb the economic ladder now than it was, say, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And that's linked to the rise in extreme income inequality in the United States over the last 40 or 50 years. So income inequality has really grown, and we are one of the countries with the greatest disparity in incomes between high income groups and low income groups, or between the top 1% and the median earner. So no matter how you measure it, we're one of the most unequal countries in terms of income distribution. The other answer, I'm afraid, is that it's kind of always been horrible for people of color. There's this idea or myth that sort of like the Horatio Alger story, that if you come to America and you work hard and you play by the rules and you save, that you can make a good life for yourself. And the data show that that's just not true for most people of color. If we take African Americans, after slavery ended, there were a series of barriers. Even without these barriers, even without Jim Crow and other kinds of discrimination, systemic discrimination, Black families after slavery started out with no financial capital, human capital, and very little social capital. And so Black families had very little to give to their children. And so the gap between Black and white was just perpetuated over time. And that was exacerbated by things like Jim Crow laws and state-sponsored terrorism in the form of public lynchings and the inability of Black people to vote for quite a long time after slavery ended and so forth. There just is a discrimination built into the institutions of this country that have combined with the rising degree of income quality and the dropping of economic ability that have kind of held people of color back for so long. So that's the other answer to your question. It's kind of always been bad for people of color. But in some ways it's gotten worse because of increasing income inequality.
Right. I think one of the things that is really difficult to unpack is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that sometimes we are talking, and particularly in the past, we're talking about a very overt kind of racism in which things are put in place quite deliberately, exactly to keep a certain group, so to speak, in their place, versus other kinds of scenarios in which something has been put in place and it is with no hostile intent whatsoever to keep a certain group in its place or subjugated or to keep them off the rungs of advancement. But it certain practices end up having that inadvertent effect. What do you think we're mostly talking about when we talk about the current situation and the intractable poverty that we see in communities of color? I mean, are these systems in place based on overt racism, or is it something else that's going on that, in a sense, is maybe trickier to talk about and maybe trickier to eradicate?
I think there's some of each. About the overt racism, as recently as a couple of decades ago, in some states, juries were sort of disproportionately white in states with kind of a large social separation between Black and white and more discrimination. Juries somehow could be disproportionately white or all white. And this was relevant in cases where the defendant was Black. And that was sort of a function that was sort of probably more intentional. As to sort of racism or Black-white disparities that are not sort of by design, I think one of the things that we're seeing now with the protests around the world over the last couple of weeks is white people are starting to wake up to the fact that the people of color have gotten a raw deal in a lot of ways, and people of color are starting to speak up and let us know that overt racism and that sort of accidental racism, that sort of a byproduct of, you know, an institution that was created a long time ago. So it really is a tough issue. And I think that some of your future speakers on this on the morning show are going to do a much better job than me of shedding some light on that. And I'm anxious to tune in and hear what they have to say.
Right. No, I think you're right. This is a conversation that needs to go forward from here, and we need to be unafraid about talking about some of these really
difficult
issues. So if you were in a position to wave a magic wand and enact some changes that would really make significant and lasting difference in terms of addressing poverty, particularly among communities of color, but let's just say poverty in general, what would be a couple of the magic spells you would cast? Or maybe to phrase the question more seriously, what would be a couple of aspects of the poverty problem that are maybe where we should begin in terms of trying to address this issue in a more meaningful way?
Well, that's a great question. So one thing that I would change if I could wave a magic wand would be funding of public schools. I would like to see all schools get an equal funding per pupil, because I think that disparities in school funding lead to disparities in educational outcomes, and that kind of cements into place a gap between people who go to good schools and people who go to underfunded schools. And the people who go to good schools are disproportionately white, and the people that go to underfunded schools are disproportionately people of color. So if we could equalize school funding on a per pupil basis, I think that would help quite a lot. I guess also if I could wave a magic wand, I would try to come up with more equal outcomes in the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system, as we've seen in such dramatic terms, treats people of color differently than white people, but we're only seeing it on the end of the interactions of police with people in communities. But really at all levels of the criminal justice system, there are disparities between the way white defendants are treated and inmates are treated, and that really needs to be addressed. This is, of course, a huge issue, but the things that come to mind are addressing disparities in school funding and the way the criminal justice system treats people of different groups.
Do we have lessons to learn from other countries who have done a better job than we have of taking some of these issues seriously? Or are our problems, in a sense, uniquely our own? And are the solutions going to have to come, in a sense, from us?
I think there are other countries that are doing things better than us. In the Scandinavian countries, for example, the prison system is more about rehabilitation than punishment. And as a result, there's a very low recidivism rate. In the United States, the prison system is really more about punishment. Conditions in jails are just depressing. There's a lot more solitary confinement, which experts say causes mental health problems. And it's really not so much about rehabilitation. So people who come out of the prison system after paying their debt to society are much less able to integrate into regular society, and the recidivism rate is much higher as a result. The Scandinavian countries do better with other kinds of issues too, besides the prison system. So I would take a look at them. I would take a look at Europe. I would take a look at Japan even, where income inequality is low. So I think we have a lot to learn from studying other countries, for sure.
Speaking of other countries, a last question that circles us back to this recession in which we find ourselves. I think one of the really intriguing things about this economic downturn for us is that the pandemic, of course, is affecting nearly every economy across the globe. And so we are not experiencing something in isolation from the difficulties of other countries. Given that we are part of a global economy that is very strongly interconnected, does that make it easier or does that make it harder for instance, the United States to recover from this, given the fact that we are, in a sense, economically tethered with other struggling economies? I wonder what you think about that.
That is a great question. We are interdependent with other countries and how globalization has increased over the last 60, 70 years, for sure. That international travel is relatively inexpensive now facilitates the transmission of this virus, right? People get infected. They don't know that they're sick. They get on a plane. They infect other people on the plane. The plane stops in some other country, and then those people from the plane disperse, and the virus just starts going in all different directions. So for that sense alone, it's going to be harder to solve the public health crisis. And this is why a lot of countries have placed limits on people coming into their countries. And that seems appropriate for now. Then we're sort of economically interconnected, as you said. Shocks in the financial market in the United States have consequences for other financial markets and so forth. If one country has a recession and its citizens feel poorer, they're not going to buy as much stuff, which means that other countries that build stuff for them are going to see a drop. What does this mean for the prospects for recovery? It's going to be very hard, I think, for one country to completely recover when the rest of the world is in recession. In a sense, we're all in this together, and we all have to get out of it together.
On that note, we finish out a wide-ranging conversation that was every bit as interesting as I knew it would be. Dr. Ron Kronovich, a professor of economics at Carthage College, I really appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to talk with me about some of these significant and complicated matters. And I appreciate this and look forward to further conversations with you on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Same to you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you will hear my interview recorded with E. Dolores Johnson, the author of a powerful and poignant memoir called Say I'm Dead. E. Dolores Johnson was the daughter of a black father and a white mother at a time when there were anti-miscegenation laws all across the country. To be a racially mixed couple was illegal in many states and fiercely frowned upon, even in places of the country where it was in fact legal. And her book is about the experience of her parents and about her own experience as someone of mixed race. A very, very interesting book. And we'll air that interview tomorrow. On Monday's morning show, I am very, very excited to share with you an interview with best-selling author Larry Tai, talking about his latest book, which is called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. It is a beautifully crafted book, meticulously researched, and much of his work springs out of a plethora of documents only very recently made available for the very first time. Next week as well, we'll be having a conversation with Corey Mason, the mayor of Racine, getting an update from him on the COVID situation and also on matters related to the police department and rethinking how policing is done in the community. Next week as well, I'll be speaking with the primary author of the Constitution's 25th Amendment. That is the amendment which calls for the vice president to step in when a president is disabled, unable to carry out the